Good afternoon. This is Bob Krueger with Thought for Food for August 2012. This program is heard on the third Wednesday of the month at 4 p.m. and repeated on the third Saturday of the month at 3 p.m. It's intended for a print and blind and print impaired audience, but hopefully it will be of interest to everyone. As I walk in the mornings, many of my routes take me by gardens that almost all feature tomatoes, and now is the time to take advantage of the tomato season. From now until the first freeze in the fall, we can enjoy a southern treat, the tomato sandwich. If tomatoes are available, there's no reason not to have a tomato sandwich every day. Tomato sandwiches pack numerous benefits. They tend to be low in calories, since the primary filling, the tomato, is mostly water. They're low in sodium, too. Tomatoes are also rich sources of vitamins A and C, as well as potassium. Another advantage is they're easy to find fresh, organic, and locally grown tomatoes, and some of you may be lucky enough to pick them out of your own garden. Another advantage is that tomato sandwiches are easy to fix. When the temperature's around 100 degrees outside, most of us don't feel like heating up the kitchen to prepare a meal. It's enough to pop some bread down on the toaster, pair a toasted tomato sandwich with a salad for a meal that is quick and cool. The BLT is a classic, but you can update it. Replace the artery-clogging bacon with something better. Natural food stores carry a variety of soy-based bacon substitutes that taste really good. Light Life Organic Smoky Tempa Strips or Smart Bacon are two examples. I've found that the bacon bits that come from soybeans work well in a BLT. Many conventional grocery stores carry Morningstar Farms veggie bacon strips. Vary the bread you use. Add flavor with fillings. There's nothing wrong with a smear of light mayonnaise. You might also try other condiments such as honey mustard, yellow mustard, or mango chutney. This summer, keep it cool and nutritious and make tomato sandwiches your diet's best friend. Now, scientific research is telling us something we've known for some time. Perfectly ripened, evenly red tomatoes stacked on top of one another in the large bins of supermarkets have been bred to look that way. As a direct consequence, they are less sweet and flavorful. Researchers at the University of California, Davis, and Cornell University have discovered that the genetic change that causes a tomato to ripen uniformly also makes it produce less sugar. The research, published in the current issue of the journal Science, has the potential to accelerate current tomato breeding and perhaps improve the quality of future commercial tomatoes. Heirloom tomatoes from your garden, while they may taste better, take longer to turn from green to red near the stem as they ripen. This uneven ripening makes them harder to commercially harvest on a large scale, said Ann Powell of the University of California, Davis, who was the lead author of this study. Incompletely red tomatoes might also be unappealing to a shopper. So, for the past 70 years, tomato breeders have been breeding a naturally occurring type that ripens uniformly. These tomatoes are now in nearly all of our pasta sauces, supermarket bins, and ketchup bottles. The genetic change found in all uniformly ripening tomatoes causes a tomato to contain 10 to 15% less sugar and reduces the amount of the compounds that give a tomato its color, aroma, and nutritional benefits. Today's commercial tomato is a lot like the delicious apple. Have you eaten a red delicious apple recently? It's been bred to travel well and is no longer delicious. Now we find that tomato research is taking place closer to home. Recent research from a global plant development company reveals that the tomato has more than 7,000 more genes than do humans, and decoding that genome could make picture-perfect grocery store tomatoes taste as good as homegrown. Since 2008, researchers at Syngenta's biotechnology hub in the Research Triangle Park, along with other scientists worldwide, have analyzed genetic sequence for two tomato varieties, the Heinz 1706, the tomato used in ketchup production, and its closest wild relative found in Peru. These investigations reveal that tomatoes boast 31,760 genes, many of which scientists are analyzing to determine how they control the fruit's growth. Yes, although we think of the tomato as a vegetable, it's actually a fruit. Tomatoes are a model crop that in many ways is well understood, said Bob Diedrich, the senior research scientist at Syngenta. Our main reason for conducting this research is so we have enough information to develop the tomatoes we want. Although the genetic structures are different, tomatoes are closely related to potatoes, tobacco plants, peppers, eggplants, and nightshade, a toxic member of the potato family. According to Rebecca Cade, a Syngenta research scientist, studying the tomato genome can increase the knowledge base around these and many other plants. The tomato is an excellent archetype for fruiting plants, she said. There's been a lot of research on how it grows, and scientists and plant breeders will be able to apply the knowledge gained from studying its DNA to other fruiting crops. Syngenta has a multi-focus goal with this research, looking for genetic answers to the tomato's shelf life, size, and firmness. However, the company's chief concern is helping farmers bring a better-tasting product to market. Once we have finished the genome sequence, we'll be able to tell the differences between a beefsteak tomato and a cherry tomato, Dietrich said. And with that information, we're able to make a beefsteak with a cherry flavor or vice versa. Ultimately, Cade says the goal is to allow plant breeders to do predictive breeding. In this scenario, someone would say, I need a tomato with this maturity date, this sugar content, and resistance to this pathogen, she said. By looking into our tomato genomes, we can take various seed lines, cross them, and get the type of desired outcome. Syngenta has been involved in tomato research since 2009, and hopefully the day will come when we can be able to purchase a tasty tomato in a grocery store. In mid-June, the Walt Disney Company, in an effort to address concerns about entertainment's role in childhood obesity, announced that all products advertised on its child-focused television channels, radio stations, and websites must comply with a strict set of new nutritional standards. A restriction on ads extends to the Sunday morning cartoons on ABC stations owned by Disney. Under the new rules, products like Capri Sun drinks and Kraft Lunchable meals, both currently Disney advertisers, along with a wide range of candy, sugared cereal, and fast food, will no longer be acceptable advertising material. The initiative, which Disney revealed at a news conference in Washington with First Lady Michelle Obama, stretches into other areas. For instance, Disney will reduce sodium by 25% in the 12 million children's meals served annually at its theme parks and create what it calls fun public service announcements promoting child exercise and healthy eating. Disney says that adopting the new advertising standards, it was largely following recommended proposed last year by federal regulators. The suggestions were aimed at inducing the food industry to overhaul the way it markets things like cereal, soda, and snacks for children. Food companies have vociferously fought government regulations on advertising, say they can take steps on their own. Disney acknowledged that most likely lose some advertising revenue, but declined to say how much, but that the benefits outweigh the downside. The Disney Channel will not currently accept traditional ads, although promotions and sponsorships are allowed. And other channels like Disney XD are supported by commercials. Disney's ad restrictions, which will not take effect until 2015 because of long-term contracts with advertisers, will apply to any programming aimed at children under age 12, which includes popular live-action programs as well as cartoons. Robert A. Iger, Disney's chairman, said he felt strongly that the companies are in a position to help with solutions to childhood obesity should do just that. But Ed, this is not altruistic. This is about smart business. Taking steps to combat childhood obesity allows Disney the opportunity to polish its brand as one of that families can trust, something that drives sales of everything from Pixar DVDs to baby clothes to theme park vacations. In addition, Disney has carefully studied the marketplace and executives say they see increasing customer demand for more nutritious food. Iger said healthier food has already become a very, very solid business for Disney. Since 2006, consumers have purchased about 2 million servings of Disney-licensed fruit and vegetables, according to the company. Margot G. Wooten, the director of nutritional policy at the Center for Science and the Public Interest, said Disney's plan put it far ahead of competitors. At the same time, she cautioned that Disney's guidelines still fall short of what her organization would like to see, particularly for cereal. Disney's new standards require cereal to contain less than 10 grams of sugar per serving, for instance, while Wooten would prefer about 6 grams. As a part of its initiative, Disney has also introduced what it calls a Mickey check in grocery store aisles. Disney licensed products that meet the criteria for limited calories, saturated fat, sodium, and sugar can display a logo, Mickey Mouse ears, and a check mark on their packaging. By the end of this year, the White House said in a news release, the Mickey check will appear on licensed food products, on qualified recipes, on products Disney.com and Family.com, and on menus and selected products of Disney's parks and resorts. Disney's standards are based on the federal government's dietary guidelines for Americans and the Federal Trade Commission's proposed guidelines for food marketing to children. Our friend Suzanne Havala-Hobbs recently wrote a column about what to eat to build healthy bones. As we age, our bones tend to become more brittle and are easier to break if we should have an accident. She begins, my annual trek to the doctor ended up the same way last month as it does every year. She recommended that I take a calcium supplement and vitamin D. I don't take supplements, and despite the repeated advice to do so, I didn't start. A new report has provided renewed vindication. A draft report by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force found benefits taking the standard commonly recommended supplement doses of vitamin D and calcium for the prevention of osteoporosis in healthy postmenopausal women. Because there's a slight increased risk of kidney stones from calcium supplements, the report recommends against daily supplements of standard doses of 400 IU or less of vitamin D and 100 milligrams or less of calcium. I feel better than ever about all the broccoli I've been eating, she says. That's because the ample evidence shows that the best way to healthy bones is a nutrient-rich diet of whole foods and regular weight-bearing exercise. In addition to getting regular doses of moderate to vigorous physical activity, most days follow those tips by getting calcium naturally through the foods you eat. Eat more frequent and bigger portions of calcium-rich fruits, vegetables, legumes, seeds, and nuts, including broccoli, bok choy, kale, okra, and all sorts of greens, including collards, turnip greens, and mustard greens. Red and white beans, dried figs, almonds, sesame seed, and blackstrap molasses. Stick with non-fat and low-fat dairy products if you buy cheese, milk, or yogurt. Watch your sodium intake, since the excessive amounts can cause your body to lose calcium. Moderate your protein intake, especially from sources high in sulfur-containing amino acids. Too much may increase the loss of calcium from the bones. Foods high in sulfur-containing amino acids include eggs, meat, fish, poultry, dairy products, nuts, and grains. The most practical approach is to eat more plant-based meals rich in green leafy vegetables and other plant food that are high in calcium. Put your effort and your money into good foods, and they're the only supplements most of us need. Thanks for the advice, Suzanne. While we may complain about the weather in other parts of the country may have an effect on our grocery bill. The worst drought in the United States in nearly 50 years is expected to drive up the price of milk, beef, and pork next year. Consumers, that's us, will bear the brunt of what the sweltering heat is driving up the cost of feed corn. Poultry prices are expected to rise immediately, the government said in a report. It's estimated that consumer price index for turkey and chicken will rise 3 to 4.5% later this year. The poultry category is the smallest animal category, and we expect to see more of an effect this year because they grow the fastest and will be the first to be impacted by higher feed prices, said Richard Volpe, an economist with the Department of Agriculture. Figures released recently show that the largest percentage increase next year in its price index is expected for beef, a rise of 4 to 5%. The price of dairy products will increase 3.5 to 4.5%, and eggs 3 to 4%. Pork is expected to rise 2.5 to 3.5%. This worse in a generation drought from Indiana to Arkansas to California is damaging crops and rural economies. It might be a $50 billion event for the economy as it blends into everything over the next four quarters, said Michael Swanson, agricultural economist at Wells Fargo in Minneapolis, the largest commercial agricultural lender. Instead of retreating from high records, food prices will advance. The USDA has said that the drought is the worst since 1988 and cut its forecast for the corn harvest by 12%. These estimates could worsen if rain does not come, said Brandon Cleithermes, a senior economist with HIS Global Insights Agricultural Group in Columbus, Missouri. We're not to that point yet, but we're trending that way, he said. The biggest U.S. crop, worth $76.5 billion last year, corn, is the main ingredient in the feed of chicken, cattle, and hogs. Soybeans have risen 21% since mid-June, and wheat has climbed 40%. These price increases could have an effect on food retailers like McDonald's, which faces higher meat costs, cereal and beverage makers such as General Mills and Coca-Cola face elevated corn and sweetener prices. In a recent program, I told of the corn industry asking the Food and Drug Administration to classify high fructose corn syrup as corn sugar. The FDA decided that since this sweetener was a liquid, it cannot be called corn sugar. Looking for a new place to eat out? The organic, all-natural, eco-friendly movement is finally coming to a fast food chain, BurgerFi, which opened recently in Cary, promises burgers from grass-fed cattle that are given no hormones or antibiotics. The beef is not local, but the product and the craft beers on the menu are, says Charlie Gaston, the director of operations. The beef comes from the Myers Ranch in Colorado, which has stringent protocols and has been designated certified humane. If you think that means pricey, Gaston says, the classic sells for $5.97. For vegetarians, there is a Quinona burger. The restaurant also boasts a Coke freestyle soda machine, which offers 150 possible flavors. Think raspberry Coke. The eco-friendly comes in other ways as well. The restaurants are built with sustainable practices. The chairs are made from recycled Coke bottles, and the tables out of compressed recycled wood. And, of course, the restaurant recycles everything from oil to bottles and cans. The Cary site is at 2052 Renaissance Park Place. This is the first North Carolina BurgerFi and the first outside of Florida for the chain that started in Delray Beach, Florida. The Cary location is owned by Burley Moss of Charlotte and Henry Harris of Charleston, South Carolina. Gaston moved his family from Cincinnati to Cary to start the burgerification of the nation. And now you see where the name comes from. Gaston, who worked in the restaurant business for 35 years, has a history of picking winners. Outback Steakhouse and Bonefish Grill being just two chains he's been affiliated with. The owners plan 20 BurgerFi restaurants for North and South Carolina. The second will open September in the Holly Park Shopping Center on Wake Forest in Raleigh, behind Trader Joe's. And they're in talks for a site in Chapel Hill and plan locations in Charlotte, Wilmington, and Asheville as well. August 1st to 4th were the dates of the American Cheese Society's annual convention, held this year in Raleigh. This is the first time the conference has come to the Southeast. Recent sites included Montreal, Seattle, and Madison, Wisconsin. It's not surprising they chose Raleigh. There's been an upswing in artisanal cheesemaking in this area, said Nora Weiser, the executive director of the American Cheese Society, and, of course, a strong agricultural tradition. Around 800 people are attending the conference from every aspect of the industry, small producers, representatives from large companies, scientists, veterinarians, chefs, and authors. Experts gave talks at the event on topics such as taste, history, food safety, and running a business. There was a cheese tasting session. An integral part of the event was the cheese competition. Over 17,000 cheeses, all made in North America, contested in 100 categories like Brie, Moderator Jack, and Mature Cheddar. All the leftover cheese was sold to the public at a very low price. During the past few years, the consumption of cheese has increased in our country. Nowhere is this more evident than in pizzas. Americans now eat an average of 33 pounds of cheese a year, and cheese has become the largest source of saturated fat. An ounce of many cheeses contains as much saturated fat as a glass of whole milk. Would you like to feel better? Honesty may boost your health. A study suggests that found telling fewer lies benefits people physically and mentally. Each week, for 10 weeks, 110 people ages 18 to 71 took a lie detector test and completed health and relationship measures assessing the number of major and minor lies they had told that week, said the lead author, Anita Kelly, a psychology professor at Notre Dame University. She presented the findings at the annual meeting of the American Psychological Association, which ended August the 5th in Orlando, Florida. When they went up in their lies, their health went down, Kelly says. And when their lies went down, their health improved. Researchers instructed half the participants to refrain from telling any lies for any reason to anyone. The other half got no such instructions. And the link between lying and improved health was significantly stronger for participants in the no-lie group. And when they told three fewer minor lies than in other weeks, for example, they had an average of four fewer mental health complaints, such as feeling tense or melancholy, and three fewer physical complaints, such as sore throat or headaches. Research has suggested that Americans lie average 11 lies a week. Kelly says the no-lie group was down to one lie a week on average. For both groups, when participants lied less in a given week, they reported that their physical and mental health was significantly better this week. It's certainly a worthy goal to have people be more genuine and interact with others in a more honest way, said psychologist Robert Feldman of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. That would be ultimately beneficial. I'm a little skeptical that it would make us all healthier, but it would make us healthier in a psychological way. I'm not certain about these results, but thought you might like to hear this story. Every year we're able to observe the anniversary of the origin of a company, a product, or someone we care about. During 2012, the Krispy Kreme Donut Company observed their 75th anniversary. That means that their delicious morsels have been around for 3/4 of a century. August the 10th, it was National S'mores Day, and most of us have enjoyed this delicious dessert made of graham crackers, marshmallows, and a chocolate bar. Getting hungry? Just a few weeks ago, Wilbur's Barbecue in Goldsboro celebrated their 50th anniversary. After 50 years, Wilbur Dean Shirley still slow cooks his pork over oak coals, letting the grease drip over the wood, pampering the meat inside a red brick shed so hot and choked with hog smoke that stepping outside into a 95-degree heat feels like a blast of air conditioning. After a career spent serving barbecue to overall-clad tobacco farmers, country lawyers and seersuckers, school board candidates, would-be governors, and joint chiefs of staff, he still shows up for work at 7 o'clock, feeling blessed to be anywhere at the age 82. It's usually crowded at Wilbur, so you'd hardly blink at the near-capacity crowd that turned out for the restaurant's 50th birthday. When Governor Beverly Perdue arrived, Shirley gave her the hug he'd give any old friend. Shirley opened Wilbur's in 1962 with 11 employees, a number that has since jumped to 85. And among those workers, you'll find Lehman Parks tending the pork after 32 years, shoving the coals that flavor Wilbur's barbecue. "Hot, isn't it?" he asked as he showed off an almost cooked side of pork. In a straight state where barbecue transcends dinner, rising to almost but not quite to the importance of communion, Wilbur's makes everyone's top 10 list, often taking the top spot. Sitting on U.S. Highway 70 on the east side of Goldsboro, an easy stop on the road to the beach, its pork has made its way into the pages of the New York Times. I feel the success of Wilbur's over the years is they've not tried to cut any corners and continue to serve the original barbecue. Congratulations to all who work at Wilbur's. Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh will which opened on August the 2nd, 1972, recently celebrated their 40th anniversary. It's difficult for any shopping center to stay competitive for such a long period of time. 10 years ago, it looked as if Crabtree Valley Mall's glory days were over. At 30 years old, the mall had lost some of its sheen with almost back-to-back openings of the streets of South Point in Durham and Triangle Town Center in Raleigh. In the first few months, both siphoned sale from Crabtree. Retail analysts were quick to talk about shifting traffic patterns. Today, Crabtree boasts of its position in the top 5% of malls nationally in terms of sales per square foot, with an average sales of $665 per square foot. Neil Rudolph, the vice president of Crabtree's management team, Plaza Associates, puts it succinctly. We weathered the storm. By comparison, Triangle Town Center has average sales last year of $287 per square foot for non-anchor tenants, according to the securities documents. Streets at South Point does not release sales information, but general manager Pat Anderson said, I can say it's a very successful center. But the Triangle's other malls aren't standing still. Streets at South Point began what it calls re-merchandising earlier this year to mark its 10th anniversary. Those plans include adding 20 new stores. Competition between South Point and Crabtree in particular remains intense. All three mentioned major malls are roughly the same size, but Rudolph says Crabtree's growth has been helped in part by how it utilizes its space. They have more department store space and we have more mall shop space. That means we have about 50% more opportunity for diverse tenants. The smaller shops have allowed Crabtree a fair amount of exclusivity, as well as 35 stores exclusive to either the Triangle or the state, Mr. Rudolph says. That's very valuable, said Brett Beamer, who tracks retail trends as the founder of the American Research Group. Even though malls have struggled mightily in the last 2 to 5 years, some of them better because they have more stores where consumers want to shop, Mr. Beamer said. Some do a better job at updating and staying contemporary. They have done a good job with their tenant base. Our congratulations to all who observed anniversaries this year. Looking for an easy meal to prepare? Don't knock canned tuna. It's rivaled in its versatility only by its price. A 5-ounce can serves two. Just add mayo and bread for about a dollar. Water-packed tuna is low in fat and calories, said Marla Naraki, a registered dietitian and certified diabetes educator in Modesto, California. It's also high in protein and contains heart-healthy omega-3 fatty acids. A 2-ounce serving, about 1/4 of a cup drained of water and packed tuna, has 10 grams of protein, 50 calories, and just 1 gram of fat. Processed tuna is the ultimate in convenience food. Open a pouch and eat, or with little or more effort, turn it into a sandwich for lunch. Tuna can also take a starring role in dinner, and with not much effort, then making a sandwich. Until next month at this time, this has been Bob Kruger with Thought for Food for August 2012. You folks take care.